And I stopped him.
Members, we will call this meeting of the House Commerce Committee to order. We are here this morning having informational hearings on a couple of bills, and we are switching the agenda. It was going to be Representative Albright first because we always like to use the alphabet whenever possible, but we are going to switch and have Representative Poston go first. So with that, to your bill.
Good morning, Chair Hoppe.
Sorry, I will interrupt one more thing. Welcome back, Peter. Nice to have you back.
Oh, thanks.
Now with that, to your bill.
Good morning, Chair Hoppe and committee. First of all, this is my first time in front of your committee, so I brought some treats, some breakfast cookies for you all this morning.
We're believers in breakfast cookies.
And I really appreciate this informational hearing this morning. And with that, I'm really just going to hand it over to my testifiers who can explain this condition and educate all of us a little bit. Carl, if you'd like to introduce yourself for the record, and go ahead.
Hi, my name is Carl Nelson. This is also my first time. I've been binge-watching on C-SPAN all weekend, and it's been pretty riveting.
So. You're going to find that this moves at quite a bit faster pace than they do in Washington. Welcome to the committee. Please proceed.
All right. Thank you. Chairman Hoppe, members of the Commerce and Regulatory Reform Committee, and Representative Poston, and former Representative Bruce Nelson, and Mrs. Nelson, good morning, and thank you very much for allowing me to speak in front of your body today. A little nervous, but my name is Carl Nelson. My wife is Nancy, and Sammy, that's right next to her, Andrew and Abby. And then I'd also like to introduce Aaron Araki. So Aaron and Tyler are the proud parents of Ava. And you'll find I brought a bunch of packets. Hopefully everybody's got a packet now. Okay. If you open it up, there's two pictures there. One is Sammy and one is Ava. And Ava is Aaron and Tyler's daughter. So Ava, Sammy, and I have a rare congenital condition called ectodermal dysplasia. I'm sure you probably most likely have not heard of it unless Representative Poston's brought it up, but it affects hair, sweat glands, nails, and teeth. The incidence of this syndrome is somewhere around two. If you look at different sources, it could be up to three. So it's somewhere around two, so I'm trying to be conservative. Based on the incidence, there would be approximately 10 to 20 children each year in Minnesota. Based on, I think, 70,000 children are born in Minnesota approximately each year. And so there'd be about 10 to 20 children each year who are affected by this syndrome. There are numerous subtypes of this condition. So ectodermal dysplasia is kind of a grouping of a bunch that have similar presentations. Subtypes of this can cause several different phenotypes. Some of these can cause hand deformities. Some of them can cause blindness, cleft lip, cleft palate, or severe skin erosions, kind of like a burn where their skin just kind of sloughs off and falls off. Ava, Sammy, and I are relatively lucky in that we have a milder form of this condition. We can sweat, we have our fingers and toes, and we won't lose our sight due to ectodermal dysplasia. We do, however, have significant dental challenges. Sammy, Ava, and I do not have breast tissue, and for me, that's not a big deal, but it certainly will be for Ava and Sammy. And as you can tell, I don't need shampoo or hair conditioner. I lost most of my hair in the 6th, 7th, 8th grade. It kind of slowly fell out. Imagine that you're in a car accident, and through no fault of your own, your jaw hits the steering wheel, and it shatters your bones. Your several teeth are dislodged. You have a difficulty speaking. You need reconstruction. Okay, you need to have implants. You need to have dentures to restore your function and your appearance. If you have medical insurance, right now that would be covered. So all that incidental cost of the surgery would all be covered. If you have a mastectomy after having a breast removed for breast cancer, right now that's covered. Breast reconstruction is covered. However, if you have a congenital anomaly and you're born without adequate teeth, your medical and dental care is not covered by insurance. I was born only with a few baby teeth and even fewer adult teeth. And I had dentures at the age of five. So This turned out to be great for human tricks during grade school, but it certainly wasn't a cosmetic thing. Okay, I needed teeth for speech development, for chewing, to minimize bone resorption of my jaw, and to help me fit in with the other kids. As I grew up, my bones stopped growing. My baby teeth and my adult teeth were not good anchors for my dentures, and because the enamel, which is part of the problem, is very weak. And so my teeth degenerated. I had to make a big decision. With few options, I decided to pursue dental implants at the University of Minnesota. As with many kids with ectodermal dysplasia, this move involves bone grafting to create strong and healthy site for the implants. Find in your packet on the left side my pantogram, which shows the secret behind my spine. So as you can tell, this treatment option, implants, is widely recognized as the best treatment for an individual like myself, and over time, it has become the standard of practice. Maybe 20 years ago, this was on the leading edge, but now implants are a critical part of our treatment plans. Every case is different, which is why you need a good oral surgeon and a good prosthodontist to try to find the right treatment plan for you. As you can see, I have 5 implants on the top and 5 implants on the bottom. I have also included an estimate for placement of a similar implant, which is also on the left side of your packet. Okay, that's the first one by the oral and maxillofacial surgery group. You'll notice the number here. It says treatment plan, $33,700. So that's just to make your picture look like this, okay? Now you need something to attach to it. So that's the second page. Dr. Lisa James, she provided a quote here. It's $20,000 for the uppers and $20,000 for the lowers. So that's $40,000. I'll put those up here. It adds up. And that's a significant cost that right now has not been addressed. The National Foundation for Ectodermal Dysplasia estimates that a person affected by ectodermal dysplasia may have to pay up to $150,000 out of pocket just for dental work in their lifetime. The majority of families can't afford this expense for something that is clearly related to a medical condition. One woman with ectodermal dysplasia from Idaho, who we met through the national organization, she had to wait 22 years with jaw pain, having to eat soft foods, and she was embarrassed to open her mouth until she found doctors willing to provide their services pro bono, as well as find a medical supply company that was willing to donate the implants for her case. She did not have the financial resources to make that step. Now, after 2 years with her implants, she still struggles a bit because she can't pay for the cleanings, which are needed to keep the implants healthy. Again, insurance won't cover her care for a medical condition. Let's fast forward here a little bit. Assume a family has been saving since their birth, which maybe the Narakis are working on, for their dental restorations for their child. And 20 years later, some of the implants failed, just like you would if you had a hip replacement or knee replacement, and it got infected and had to be removed. You have to have a revision done. Now that adult has another round of surgeries ahead of him. I had failed an implant in my lower jaw, and I required some restoration work with bone grafting right on this area, bone grafting, and required several surgeries to stage it so I could continue to work with throughout the process. Again, insurance didn't cover the cost of the implants during this step. I'll also need to replace my upper implants, which you'll see on here. These are the ones that were done at the University of Minnesota a long time ago, and they have improved these implants. These implants are known to fail after some time. Again, insurance is not willing to cover the cost of these implants, and the procedure that I need to do in order to make the new implants work is called a sinus lift. And that's a bone grafting procedure where we push the sinus lining up and they pack bone grafting underneath it to fill in bone. Okay. All right. Medical insurance companies say that this work is dental. Dental companies, insurance companies say it's cosmetic and that they also have low coverage caps. We are caught in the middle. and we need your help. Families who have fought the insurance companies have taken several years of their efforts, countless appeal letters, phone calls, time off of work just to try to get their needs met. In reviewing the Minnesota statutes, I've identified areas of improvement to help protect people with a congenital anomaly. On the left side of your packet, I have included two statutes that I found on the web, and there may be more, but these are the ones that I found initially. So the first one shows the protection for cleft lip, cleft palate community. It states that oral surgery and orthodontia should be covered as long as the patient is a dependent. I highlighted one section, but basically this calls out, it's a precedent that calls out that there is precedent for dental treatment to be included in the plans, medical plans for a condition. That's 62A.042. And please consider modifying the statute to include restorations, including dental implants of other congenital anomalies besides cleft lip and cleft palate, because there are other groups that could benefit from a protection like that. And also extend the timeline to beyond the age of 18, since every restoration is different. In most cases for ectodermal dysplasia, we use dentures until our bones are set. And at that point, once our bones are set, then we can make a better, more permanent fix. And that would be after 18, most likely. It's the other statute that I'd like to highlight here is includes a protection for people with alopecia areata. And as you can tell, I have alopecia. I don't necessarily have alopecia areata. So it's a very companies in the past have been very stringent about using those terms. So when I was in the eighth grade, I did not want to wear a wig, but I did because I had scarring and patchy spots all over. So that started when I was in fifth or sixth grade. And I did not want to be wearing a wig, I can tell you that. But I felt it was the right thing to do at that time. It was a very emotional time for me as a young adult, trying to fit in, trying to look cool. But I did succeed, FYI, just so you know. My parents were denied coverage several times because I didn't have alopecia areata. So please consider changing the language in the statute to provide the protection for people with ectodermal dysplasia or premature hair loss due to a congenital anomaly or disease process as determined by the treating provider. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'd like to thank you again for letting me come here and talk. Please consider working with Representative Poston to make some legislative changes so we don't have to fight for every tooth, every strand of hair, or every breast. There are so many aspects of ectodermal dysplasia that we cannot fix, sweating, etc., itchy skin, but dental restorations, wigs, and breast reconstruction are items that we can address. So thank you very much. And Aaron or Nancy or anybody else would like to come and talk?
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. If there's anybody else that does want to come down and speak to the committee, you're more than welcome to.
I'll try to get my stuff out of the way here for you.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape and proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Chairman. I'm Beverly Nelson. I'm Carl's mother. And I'm not going to embarrass him, but I will
That's okay. We like to embarrass him. Yeah.
I've already embarrassed him by coming up here, so let me tell you. But we have walked this walk with Carl for many, many years, and I can speak personally to the difficulty. And Bruce, his father, of course, was in the legislature at the time. And we fought everything trying to get coverage for his dentures, and this was a little guy. We often had trouble finding his dentures because once in a while he hung them on the rhubarb at the farm. But I just want to encourage any help that you can give to these folks who are dealing with ectodermal dysplasia. And as Carl said, there are many, many forms of it. We've been fortunate to have a son with as much spirit as he has to come forward and do what he can for other families now. We thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions I can tell you that when we were working diligently trying to get help with both the hair prostheses is what they were, we needed to call them for insurance coverage, which didn't always work. We were told that these things were all cosmetic issues and would not be covered. And I recall writing a letter to, I don't remember, Bruce, was it the insurance commissioner, whomever it was, I can't remember anymore. And I said, I would happily bring my young son down without his teeth and without his hair, and you tell me that it's for cosmetic purposes. So anything that anybody can do to expand on this would be very helpful. And I'm, his dad and I are very proud of what he's trying to do for other families. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mrs. Nelson. You should be proud. He did a nice job. Ma'am, go ahead and identify yourself for the record, and please proceed.
I am Erin Araki. I am Ava's mother, so the photo of the blonde 2-year-old in your packet. Very proud parent of her. We're new to ectodermal dysplasia. My husband and I do not have ectodermal dysplasia. It was a rare genetic mutation with Ava. So we've been learning a ton. We're so lucky to have Carl and Nancy and to have Representative Poston here as our advocate for this. But Carl did mention earlier, I have a lot of friends or nieces, nephews, little kids that their parents are starting to save for college or start saving for their education. And my husband and I are starting to save for Ava's dental because we know the estimated cost right now is about $150,000 that we can expect to pay out of pocket for her dental. And these kids, they deal with so much. So if we can help with that financial burden, and with dental, it's not just cosmetic. They need their teeth for speech, for eating, so many other reasons. And so we thank you. I thank you from the bottom of my heart for this opportunity. And, yeah, if you have any questions, we are more than happy to answer.
Thank you very much. Members, any questions for any of the testifiers? Representative Lunan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just for clarity, I remember when in the 80s we went through this with TMJ and where they broadened the dental coverage. But is the so in Statute 62A, I'm looking right at it here, it looks like the coverage is mandated. Is the denial of coverage because they're contending that the whole thing is elective? Is that what the denial is based on? Somebody wants to...
Mr. Nelson, if you want to come back up and...
In my understanding, I mean, obviously, I don't know every single case for families as they apply, but there are many, most insurance have dental exclusion, or dental exclusions with implants, specifically exclusions for implants.
Thank you. Representative Lunan?
Okay, again, I'm looking at... statute 62A.042, the one you cited. And in paragraph B, coverage under paragraph A, which is explaining who has to pay, includes benefits for inpatient or outpatient expenses arising from medical and dental treatment up to a limiting age of coverage.
And then it does go on to say, involving the management of the birth defects known as cleft lip, cleft palate.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson.
Thank you. The again, back in the day, I don't write health insurance now. When I was a brand new agent, I did in the early 80s. And I remember when the TMJ, which was a dental procedure that had to do with headaches and job mobility, that they did. This has been, things like this have been done before to go through and specifically solve the problem. So there isn't, we aren't blazing absolute new ground here.
And Mr. Nelson, and maybe you said it and I didn't catch it, about ballpark, how many people in Minnesota are we talking about?
Well, I'll give you, we have a national foundation has a database of families. And right in Minnesota, we think there's about 200 to 300 families, but that must be underrepresented. One, we have a couple things that confuse that. One, we have there are forms of this that are carriers, or they're X-linked, and so the females would not be as a strong of a phenotype or expression of the genetic data. And so the males would be the predominant. So there's going to be a percentage that has a very maybe small changes. And then there's also going to be people who just don't connect with our organization, who don't feel like they want that resource. So, I mean, theoretically, based on the incidence, there's 10 to 20 children each year. So if you multiply that by 80.
Got it.
So, okay.
Thank you, sir. Ms. Kmit, did you want to come down and... Okay, that's fine. Okay. Members, any other questions? Anybody else that wants to speak on this? Seeing nobody coming down, Mr. Nelson and everybody that testified, you did a very nice job.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, Representative Poston.
Thank you, Chair Hoppe and committee. And I don't see a lot of those cookies being consumed, so please take them back to your staff.
The cameras are on right now. As soon as the cameras are off, the cookies will disappear in a hurry. They passed right by me. So with that, Representative Poston, thank you very much. Representative Albright, you're up next.
Thank you, Chair Hoppe.
Representative Anderson, did you get a chance to look at the minutes from our last meeting?
I did, Chair Hoppe.
I remember saying that you read them as soon as they were done last week, so
yes.
2 weeks ago, whatever it was. And members, any comments, questions, concerns about the meeting, the minutes from our last meeting? Seeing none, let's move approval of those of the Anderson motion to approve the minutes. Those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, members. Thank you, Representative Anderson. I'm just going to speak for the committee. We're in trouble if you're giving technical advice, Representative Albright.
Chair Hoppe, thank you for your confidence in me this morning.
Oh, look, it's working. Representative Albright, welcome to the committee. Please proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, I would be remiss if I did not extend best wishes to all the mothers around the table belatedly for a happy Mother's Day.
Wait, what?
Happy Mother's Day. Mr. Chair, you're...
Told me that Friday.
I say that because for most of us in the room who celebrated with our children yesterday, it was a very happy occasion. Filled with the joy and laughter that children bring to their parents, knowing that they are healthy, well, and making progress towards the aspirations and dreams that their parents have for them when they were first born. But unfortunately for some in this room, particularly the family and parents to my right, your left, that has not been the case. And so I introduce to you Brian and Natalie Barnes, who are the son, or are the parents of a son by the name of Parker, who sits behind us. Their story is one of sorrow, tragedy, frustration, and an overall grinding process of trying to discern how to get the treatment already approved for their son. Mr. Chair and and members, we are not here to decry the system, more as to ask and request that the system recognize the needs of those far and wide that suffer from PANDAS. And with that, Mr. Chair and members, I will introduce the Barnes to you.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Mr. or Mrs. Barnes, whoever wants to go first, please identify yourself for the tape and proceed. And welcome to the committee, by the way.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you being here and taking the time. My name is Brian Barnes, my wife Natalie Barnes. We're going to start with a very brief segment of a video I put together. I apologize to the members who've seen it before in the previous committees. I'm going to truncate it a little bit at about the halfway point in the interest of time to give you an introduction to our experience with PANDAS.
This is how Parker came into the world, and little changed as he grew. He was a great kid, a great baby, a wonderful young man. We're very proud of him. He lived with a normal family, in a normal place, just like normal kids.
That felt good?
Parker's character and nature were stellar. He's loose, he's affable. He's very relaxed, he's organized, knows what he needs to do, and he gets it done. It's always been that way. He's a great student, he's adored by his teachers, he loves his family and friends. He's also had strep 14 times. In January and February of 2017, he began having instant bouts of incapacitating short-lived depression. Small tics started showing up as well. He had a throat clearing that wouldn't go away, and it wasn't because he had a cold. Social anxiety crept in. He didn't want to play with others like he did before. We got a note from his teacher. I made an appointment with a psychologist. Then on April 18th, he attempted suicide. He got a one-week stay in an adolescent psychiatric hospital. My wife took an absence from work for 7 weeks to care for him. When we got him out of the psychiatric hospital, they didn't have an answer, so we took him to every pediatrician, general MD, immunologist, chiropractor, neurologist, and psychiatrist we could find. Few had answers, except one thing kept creeping up: pandas. We started him on anti-inflammatories and antibiotics. They didn't seem to really make much difference because rages soon came on. Requiring 24-hour care and observation. Psychosis came in. Intrusive thoughts. He was a flight risk and would bolt out the door.
You okay?
We couldn't let him be more than 6 inches from us. We followed him everywhere he went in the house, especially if he was anywhere near a door. He was antisocial. He wouldn't go anywhere. He wouldn't see anybody.
You're going to hurt yourself on the edge right here. Parker.
Obsessive compulsive disorder came in very strong. He lost some of his fine motor skills. He'd always been an artist, and he could no longer control himself. He couldn't do math in his head, too. He'd only tolerate half days at best for the last month of school, and even that was sketchy. Finally, in July, after a long battle with our insurance carrier, he started getting IVIG treatments.
In the interest of time, I'll truncate it. There is about 2 minutes remaining on that. Our understanding was the purpose of coming before you is to justify the financial concerns involved with treating kids with pandas. Pans and pandas, and I give you each an outline to follow along and for your own keeping. Pans and pandas identified about 30 years ago. Since that time, it's been studied and verified as its own unique condition with parameters for diagnosis and treatments. This bill's about pandas and pandas kids, who it affects, what that does to them, whether or not they should be treated, and what that costs. Pandas and pandas is estimated to strike 1 in 200 children to some degree of influence, and thankful to the previous speaker with his rough numbers, the number of children born in the state, which I acquired from him, thank you. I quickly tabulated that to be about 5,000 in Minnesota. Roughly 5% of those affected will require advanced treatments such as plasmapheresis, IVIG, rituximab, and cyclophosphamide. Hope I didn't butcher that. The cost of treatment of all pandas kids is estimated to be between 3/10 of a cent and 4 cents per taxpayer per month, according to the Center for Health Information and Analysis, which was done by the state of Massachusetts. The state of Illinois has already passed a similar legislation to ours in June of last year, and many other states have similar policies pending. One of the things that we key in on this is the required standard of care, as outlined by the Journal of Child and Adolescent Psychopharmacology. My wife would like to speak on that.
Good morning, committee chairs.
Good morning.
And members. I'm Natalie Barnes. I am a parent, obviously, of my son Parker, who is a PANDAS patient. And I'm also a nurse of almost 25 years in the state of Minnesota. So why would we as parents sit before you? The Finance Committee of the Minnesota House of Representatives for the Health and Human Services to support a bill mandating insurance coverage for a specific disease, PANDAS and pandas. As a board-certified nurse in the state of Minnesota, we follow standards of care in every area in which I've ever been employed. A standard of care is defined as a medical or psychological treatment guideline and can be very general or specific. It specifies appropriate treatment based on scientific evidence and collaboration between medical and or psychological professionals involved in the treatment or given condition. These standards of care are not only for the safety of each patient, but to provide the most cost-effective and appropriate care designated by the severity of the need. When standards of care are not followed or are delayed, in our case, there are not only risks to the patient's health and outcome, but the lack of appropriate care impacts the hospitals, the clinics, the health systems, the communities, and the state, both fiscally and ethically. In July 2017, a consortium of 40 physicians published treatment guidelines for PANDAS and PANS in the Journal of Child and Adolescent Psychopharmacology that is in my right hand right now. These treatment guidelines are the standard of care in which physicians and mid-level providers such as nurse practitioners and physician assistants in the state of Minnesota are attempting to order and implement to maximize the care and minimize the long-term costs of treatment to children with PANS and PANDAS. They are unable to provide such treatment as insurance companies continue to deny the very care recommended. In our case, we had three letters of medical necessity from three different specialists indicating the need for our son to have IVIG. We also had an additional two Minnesota family physicians willing to write letters if needed, and we were denied by Blue Cross Blue Shield as they had not adopted the standard of care outlined. By the way, they were also, these outlines, these standards of care were included in our appeal to Blue Cross Blue Shield, and they still denied us. The only way that we got coverage, honestly, was because we have a self-insured plan, and I begged my employer to help us as my son was deteriorating, as you saw in the video, deteriorating before our eyes. This does not just affect our son. This is 1 in 200 kids, but of that 5%. So if you think about 70,000 kids being born a year, 1,000 of those kids could be seriously impacted by this disease. And as a mental health institutions are bursting at the seams, it is the wrong thing to actually implement care and guidelines that are not specific to what they need, which is medical care and treatment guidelines that are in this specific treatment guideline printed and standardized. Furthermore, we contact the Attorney General's office, Lori Swanson, because according to Blue Cross Blue Shield documentation, a neurologist reviewed our appeal. However, when we queried our ordering physician, he completed a peer-to-peer with a general pediatrician. Even with the standards of care and treatment guidelines in place, insurance companies continue to deny these children the future of our state. The delay in care and lack of care can mean an increase in severity, which is in the case of our son, and unfortunately an increase in fiscal impact to not only families, the insurance companies themselves, employers, and this fine state.
And in our case, because of the required insurance appeals, it was 4 months before we finally got approval, and we were one of the lucky ones. So we count ourselves blessed that way. And our son deteriorated the whole time. So as far as costs go, cost of treating a child, it's a simple question. Which is more cost-effective, maintaining a chronically ill child, such as Parker became, or maintaining a healthy child, such as he was before and will be again? PANDAS and PANS is well documented and definitively treatable. I want to make sure I harp on that point because I'm sure the insurance companies will try and argue otherwise. It's really not a debate. If they're not treated, the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality estimates the average stay in hospital for mental health being $5,700 per stay. Average stay is 8 days. The actual number varies widely by state and disorder. This is only an example. I put it forth as PANDAS and PANS kids may flare frequently and repeatedly and require admission each time if their condition is not brought under control and if they don't get coverage to get it under control. PANDAS and PANS kids are typically sent down a spiraling trail that prescribes a multitude of antipsychotic drugs from psychiatrists who try drug after drug, which only worsens their symptoms. Generally speaking, the kid's response is atypical to these drugs. Individual education plans must be instituted. Some kids require special teachers and even home teaching, such as our son does. Extra child care costs to the parents due to child care and special attendance. This could be part-time to full-time. Plus, we personally spend $2,000 a month or so in child care costs for our son. He requires someone to be with him at all times, and when we're working, someone has to be there. And then lost wages and productivity for the parents as they attend to their child and psychotic flares, breakdowns, and extended doctor's appointments and hospital stays. We've been from as far north as Staples, Minnesota, and as far south as Mayo, and we've been to Washington, D.C. and back. Now, the cost of treating. The vast majority of kids can have their symptoms eradicated by long-term antibiotics, over-the-counter anti-inflammatories, and steroids. Insurance companies typically raise issue with or refuse coverage even for these simple treatments. and that's the biggest hurdle percentage-wise.
And I'd like to add on that is our son has to have similar to rheumatic fever standards of antibiotic use, and I have to fight every single month to get his antibiotics, every month. And he's a severe case. So I just pay for him cash out of pocket and just say, work it out, because my son needs this. That's just one hurdle.
The small percentage that require advanced treatments like our son do so to relieve the daily torture of these conditions and eliminate the expenses of not receiving adequate care as outlined above. As previously mentioned, physicians and insurance companies have an obligation to provide a standard of care to their patients. The standard is clearly outlined in the JCAP, which my wife showed you. There's a billing code pending in the ICD-11 that's due for print in June, and the insurance companies may want to quote that. However, it will take a number of years before those codes come into play and begin being used. Per medical council, doctors are only now applying ICD-9 codes, so we're two steps behind. These kids need cooperation from the insurance companies today. Besides, just because there's a code to classify it doesn't mean the insurance companies will start paying for it. They need to be held accountable for these patients. The existence of PANDAS and PANDAS is no longer debatable. The treatment guidelines are well established, outlined, and available for the JCAP. The only thing experimental about it is whether or not the ill child's insurance carrier will cover it. Financial coverage is shaky at best, leaving the family members liable for the balance. Numbers for the few can be crippling, and this is what insurance is for. It's when you're slated with a debt that is outstanding, your insurance is there to pick it up. For the few who are approved, insurance companies are playing a game with these very ill children. They want to postpone and stall their clients, requiring 2, 3, and sometimes 4 appeals to get coverage, even if they get it. Meanwhile, the kids' months tick by and the kids' condition worsens. Medical necessity is most often described by insurance companies as a specific medical, health care, supply, or hospital service required for the treatment of a medical symptom or condition, and that the service, supply, or care provided is the most efficient and economical service which can be safely provided. Would you leave a child as ours in that state in which you was? Is that efficient? Is that economical? And is that even ethical? I almost made it through. Any questions?
Representative Nash.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. To the Barneses, we met when you testified in front of the Government Operations Committee, and I don't think any of us had ever heard of this until that night, but about a week later or less, my friends, the Johnsons, Aaron and Inga, called. They're going through the same thing, and I think you two have made that connection. But I appreciate you coming. It's obviously very difficult to talk about. I appreciate Representative Albright picking this up, but members, you know, 1 in 200, statistically, we're never going to meet anybody that is in that category, but people I've gone to church with for 15 years are going through this, so it is worth the effort that we can expend to help families like yours out.
I concur.
Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to our testifiers. Thank you for sharing your story, and I'm sorry for what you're going through. I just had a couple of questions. In the protocol, you said it was a rheumatic fever protocol that he's being treated for, and I'm just wondering if you could share what kind of antibiotics and what the cost is. You know, you said you were paying for them out of pocket, to give us a sense of what those cost. And I noticed you said over-the-counter anti-inflammatories, excuse me, and steroids. Can you give us a sense of what those cost on a monthly basis? Okay, I'll speak to that. So when I say rheumatic fever, it's not that he has rheumatic fever, but of course that they follow a protocol, and for him it's amoxicillin twice a day, and the cost of that per month is around $150 paid for a cash out of pocket, which doesn't seem like much, but it adds up over time until he's 21. But we just pay for it out of our own pocket and just wait for the insurance to kick in. As far as the steroids and the ANSAIDs, honestly, this is such an inexpensive
disease process to treat if you catch it early. Antibiotics, you know, if you just pay for a prescription, are usually probably less than $20 to $30 for most people, or even less than that. NSAIDs are just ibuprofen over the counter. And then, of course, steroids. Prednisone is typically the oral option that they give, and it is probably one of the cheapest, most generic medications that you can provide for any specific disease process. So that would be like an $11 copay for us for the actual steroids. So if you catch this early, then, you know, and that's most of those kids. But when you're saying that you see these severe cases, the severe cases really are going to start making an impact, and this is something that I didn't really focus on as much, but our mental health in this state is so impacted already. And to actually put these kids into mental institutions that are actually providing the appropriate care for people that need those treatments, this is a medical condition with psychiatric symptoms. So it falls in this kind of gray zone. And if you don't treat them appropriately with the medical, then you end up going down an entire psychiatric path and putting so much more impact, an unnecessary fiscal impact on a system that's already having challenges beyond measure to care for the patients that they already have. So I hope that actually makes sense to all of you as to the importance of making sure that you identify the appropriate treatment and then, of course, deal with it in the way that's going to be best for those patients.
Can I ask one follow-up to that? So you mentioned when you were, one of you mentioned when you were testifying that the symptoms are eradicated. If it's caught early and you get on the antibiotic treatment and the systems, is that, do they kind of wean off this as they get older, or is it a constant lifelong needing the antibiotics? Does this work?
Yeah, so it's an autoimmune. So pediatric autoimmune neuropsychiatric disorder associated with strep infections. So for him, it was strep. There's other disease processes that can cause similar things, and that's why there's PANS. So you can actually have flares, but typically if you can get things under control, you can live a very, very normal life. And most of the kids that have actually even had IVIG and that we know that have had successful treatment early on with either antibiotics and NSAIDs, or if they've had to go and they're more serious, the IVIG, they go on to college and they live fruitful, productive lives. If you don't catch it, you can actually end up with brain damage.
Thank you. And Representative Barr, thank you for letting me jump in.
Thank you. So I kind of want to follow up with what you were saying. So so some of the damage is not irreversible if it happens, but if you catch it and treat it, you can at least reduce or lessen some of the things that we were seeing on the video. Is that correct?
From what we gather, I mean, our hope and prayer is that he comes back to entirely normal. He's actually sitting behind us right now. We probably wouldn't have had that a year ago. So we're on our journey. We're not there yet, but we're getting there.
Representative Barr.
Thank you. My last question is, in your testimony, you talked about it takes a number of years for these codes to come into play, and I was just wondering if anybody could explain why. I mean,
that's a very good question. I will tell you, I went to a conference out in New York City, and there were people there from all over the world. And one specific doctor from Denmark, of course, they have the ability to track patients, and they can implement codes very quickly because they have socialized medicine. And I'm not promoting a stance on that. I'm just saying that they were able to implement ICD codes quite quickly as a result of having a standardized approach. And so I think part of it is that that makes a big difference in the United States versus other nations. But I can't speak to it specifically, but that was at least what I observed.
Thank you.
And one other, is the prevalence of this increasing nationally or internationally, do you know? Are we just better at detecting it?
I think, from what I gather, and they said that it's been recognized for the last 30 years, is really, truly, I think that sometimes it just went undiagnosed. And so now, just like many other disease processes, you know, once you know the symptoms and you have a specific treatment guideline, you have specific diagnostic criteria, you actually begin noticing and then able to treat more significantly. So I think you're going to find that over the course of the next decades, some changes in not only PANS PANDAS patients being identified, but also other patients being identified in the mental health area.
Representative Lumen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to the testifiers. Did you have a chance to check, are there any insurers that do cover this?
I don't know if we spoke to this, but in the state of Illinois, they actually mandated coverage last year in June. And since then, they actually did put it into, and that was part of the reason why we got coverage for our son, was that we were able to use the coverage from Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota that covers five other states and has an actual statement within their IVIG coverage for medical necessity, given certain criteria. Again, it follows the JCAP. It follows these treatment guidelines as to how severe that patient needs to be, what things have already been tried, et cetera, before they actually go ahead and use a more intense treatment. So, yes, there are some, but even then, even though it's mandated, of course, they, you know, insurance companies are out there to obviously help us, but they're also out there to make money. So, unfortunately, they've had some challenges even mandating it when it's been in law.
Thank you, Mr. and Mrs. Barnes. Representative Luna.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, yeah, you know, what this is a situation that I think is actually pretty common where in healthcare, for instance, you have non-medical people telling medical people what to do medically. And when we go forward addressing the healthcare issue, I think it's important to prioritize that health occurrence is between the patient and the doctor, and that the role that the insurance company pays is to be one of indemnity, that we don't have other forces coming in and saying this is what you can and can't do in these specific situations. I guess we've kind of heard a pattern of these now, certainly this year and a little bit last year regarding this. It's the same mechanics. That's just my comment.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to come down and speak? Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks to the Barneses again. I've seen you in every committee I sit on now, and your story is really compelling, and we have a connection. And so it's an illness that I've learned a lot about since meeting the Barneses, and I have said this in every committee. I think now that you've heard about pandas, you're going to be surprised at how much you question things when you see it with your friends or whatever. But with regard to the change in the illness and the way strep impacts the body and the connection to rheumatic fever, that used to be a real common complication of strep, which affected the heart. But very often what they're finding now is that strep is starting to impact the brain instead. So there's a change in the way that this disease is, and it's so common and so many people have it, and you don't know to be afraid of strep when your kid presents with strep and you don't know until you start putting these pieces together that you're actually dealing with this disease impacting the brain in a way that I don't think we're aware of before. So to the question, Mr. Chair, that you asked about, is it more common or are we diagnosing it better? I think that it's both, because I do think that this illness is changing the way it affects people's bodies as diseases do.
Thank you, Representative Halverson. Mr. Barnes.
I'd like to clarify the strep isn't actually impacting the brain. It's the body's immune response to the strep that's impacting the brain. There are forms of cerebral encephalitis where it actually is an infectious agent that attacks the brain and makes that happen. Different pathways to a similar conclusion. But, it's the immune response that's kicking in and causing it to happen. So, it can be triggered through strep, and it can be triggered through getting the flu. It can be triggered through a variety of illnesses, viruses, and bacteria that you may acquire that launches the body off in this direction. So, but strep is certainly the most common and the most likely culprit.
Thank you, Mr. Barnes. Mr. Graves or Ms. Commit, do you two want to come down? Welcome back to the committee. Whoever wants to go first, please start whenever you're situated.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Catherine Commit. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, which is the trade association that represents the seven nonprofit health plans in Minnesota. Thanks for the opportunity to testify. And I just want to say recently I had an opportunity to speak with Representative Poston and Mr. Nelson about House File 4143, which is Representative Poston's bill on how health plans do provide coverage for ectodermal dysplasia. Because ectodermal dysplasias affect people in different ways, there is not one specific treatment for this condition, and the most appropriate treatment for one person may not be the right treatment for another person with a different presentation of this condition. As Mr. Nelson did say, there are a number of existing health benefit mandates in place already, including things like reconstructive surgery, dental and podiatry coverage, cleft lip and cleft palate, hospitalization and anesthesia for dental procedures, hearing aids, et cetera. I think one of the challenges, as always, with benefit mandates is it's important to understand that in passing a state law, a state mandated benefit, it's really only going to reach about 21 or so percent of the population. And that's because most people get their health insurance through their employer, and most employers are self-funded, which means they are exempt from state laws, state benefit mandates, state taxes, et cetera. And as you heard the Barnes family testified earlier, they, in fact, are covered by a self-funded plan or a self-insured plan. They might hire Blue Cross and Blue Shield, in this case, to administer the plan on their behalf, but the reality is that it's the employer who is making the decision. And, you know, kudos to Mrs. Barnes for going to her employer and talking with the Human Resources Department and saying this is really important, because not all employers and their personnel departments are familiar with all of the latest and emerging conditions that are out there. It would be helpful to understand, to better understand the number of people affected by both ectodermal dysplasia and PANDAS and how they are affected. And to that end, we fully support the legislation to create an advisory council on rare diseases through the University of Minnesota Board of Regents. This is language that is included in the omnibus HHS bill articles authored by Representative Matt Dean. The advisory council will study rare diseases and provide advice on research, diagnosis, treatment, and education. And part of the duties of the advisory council will be to develop resources or recommendations relating to the quality of and access to treatments for people with rare diseases. Assuming this bill is enacted, the advisory council will be required to submit a report to the legislature on an annual basis beginning January 1, 2019. And the advisory council really will be a good venue for helping providers, advocates, state agencies, and other members of the healthcare community to study and learn more about both ectodermal dysplasia and PANDAS. I will also just mention that Representative Poston, recognizing the value that this this advisory council would bring, sought and got an amendment added to that language to include a dental, someone with a seat on the advisory council by somebody who has dental expertise in these types of conditions. So there will be somebody participating on the council who can focus specifically on those issues. And with respect to PANDAS, the condition known as PANDAS, health plans do cover the conditions that are associated with PANDAS, which includes coverage of antibiotics and medications related to psychiatric symptoms. However, there is very little evidence to support immunoglobulin therapy or IVIG for PANDAS. At this time, that treatment is still considered unproven and therefore investigational and experimental. In fact, there are national scientific evidence-based databases that recommend against covering IVIG for PANDAS. There's published literature that also shows that there's no statistical difference between IVIG and a placebo. Clearly, what this says to us is clearly more clinical trials are needed so that the medical community can learn which treatments work and which treatments do not. Health plans are always reviewing reevaluating and updating their coverage policies to make sure they reflect coverage that offers the best care for patients. PANDAS is an emerging condition that everyone in the medical community is learning more about, and that's why we support the creation of the PANDAS Advisory Council. This is legislation that is also being carried by Representative Albright. And this council, advisory council, will help educate parents, patients, physicians, community advocates, researchers, psychologists, psychiatrists, experts in autism, social workers, educators, and health plans. This is also the right venue to create greater education and awareness about the research, diagnosis, and treatment relating to PANDAS. We thank Representative Albright for his willingness to include a health plan representative to serve on the PANDAS Advisory Council. Like the benefit mandate legislation for ectodermal dysplasia, the PANDAS bill also faces the same constraints about applying only to the fully insured market. With that said, we welcome the opportunity to work with the stakeholders on these two very important medical conditions. So thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Ms. Commit. Mr. Graves?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Bentley Graves. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. First of all, I want to thank both the authors for working with their constituents and the folks in the stakeholder community to bring these important topics forward. Both the Nelsons and the Barneses, I think everyone would agree, exhibited a lot of courage and a lot of steadfastness and carrying this message to the legislature and to the public and trying to raise awareness about these issues. And, you know, these are both issues that I've only learned recently about. But it's clearly a situation where, you know, these issues, though, although they may affect a small portion of people, have a significant impact on their lives. And so, you know, recognizing that, I want to thank the authors for bringing them forward. Ms. Commit, I think, covered the landscape fairly well. You know, as most folks on this committee know, when these questions about adding to the state's list of mandated coverage come before the legislature, you know, we in the business community, particularly on behalf of the small employers that we represent, who are in that small sliver of the fully insured market, you know, do always feel it incumbent upon us to remind those of you that are weighing the policy implications of these decisions that each of these issues, you know, again affects folks very deeply. But when it leads to adding to the list of things that are mandated coverage in Minnesota, we're adding to already a very long list. You know, Minnesota already requires coverage for more than 60 benefits. By some counts, that leads the nation. You know, as you know, that puts Minnesota in the top five across the country, and all those come with a cost. And you know, again, that has to be weighed against the cost that you know these families are experiencing. But it's nevertheless a concern for us and one that we feel responsibility to raise to the legislature, to policymakers as you're looking at these issues. And we also appreciate the work that's been done both on the Rare Disease Advisory Council and the PANDAS Advisory Council as part of the legislation that's moving forward this session. We do believe that may be a helpful place to carry on this conversation and identify those ways in which coverage can be changed or treatment can be changed to ensure that the folks that are dealing with these diseases can get the treatment and the coverage and the help that they need. So, again, appreciate the opportunity to testify and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Graves. Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and appreciate Ms. Schmidt and Mr. Graves coming up to talk about some of the complexities. I think that Ms. Commit, you identified, you know, some of the hurdles that we have in terms of people getting to access and understand their health care. But at the same time, I do want to say I've had a lot of conversations with a lot of folks this year about the way that the healthcare system is not working for them. And I do think that there are system-wide hurdles. We had a group out here yesterday or was it Saturday, talking about the high cost of insulin, and the way that it's driving people away from getting, the treatment they need with regard to their diabetes, and insulin is life for diabetics. And I think the same is true when your child is, it's really, to be in a situation where We have parents coming to us saying our kids can't get the care that they need. The pressure's on. And with regard to the number of mandates Minnesota has, we do have a lot of mandates. But I do think that the mandates that Minnesota has put in place has really changed the landscape of healthcare in a lot of ways, and it's made us leaders. Keep in mind, some of the mandates that are there are maternity care, cancer care, Lyme disease coverage. I mean, this is really important stuff. So I do think that the legislature does play a role in helping to push fair health care for patients. At the same time, I think that we absolutely need to attack a system-wide approach as well. And that's why I'm glad these working groups are coming forward as well, and that payers and providers and patients and everybody are part of this, because it's a system-wide problem. I mean, we're trying to pay for treatments for folks at the same time that we're watching drug manufacturers increase the price of a medication like insulin that was developed with public dollars 1,000% in order to make money. This is a problem, and I think that we really need to name it, because this is also part of the hurdle for folks getting the treatment that they need. And I think that we need, instead of just saying no, we can't have any more mandates, I think we need to ask why are people asking for these mandates, and where is the system failing us, and really work together to get to the root problems as well. So that's all I needed to say.
Thank you, Representative Helverson. Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and more of a comment than a question. But you know, I'm a systems thinker, and typically I'm not a fan of unfunded mandates and things like that. But I also look at specifically the cost of paying for a particular condition, and I get that it costs more to add it to a health plan. But I also, because I work with a lot of small businesses, recognize the cost to having an employee not being able to be at work and not being able to be productive and other things like that. So I think when we look at some of these things, we have to look across the system of costs, not just the specific cost of dealing with the disease. And so you made a comment about only 21% of plans would be impacted. And I'm a numbers gal, so I went to the 5,000 kids in Minnesota that are impacted by this and multiplied it by 21%, which I get that they may not be in those plans, but that's over 1,000 kids impacted. And when I look at the cost of one stay, if they had to go into a medical facility, and I have been looking into some of those medical facilities, mental health type of facilities in the hospitals related to a lot of the work we're doing on mental health care, that's a pretty significant cost. So I think, you know, we need to start really thinking about system-wide the cost, not just, you know, tunnel vision and looking at here's one slice, one condition, and what's the cost of treating that. And as businesses, I would hope we would look at, okay, what's the cost to include that in our plan, but then what are the other costs, and then start to look at how we balance out those costs. So that's all I wanted to comment on. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Barr. We're rapidly running out of time, but is there anyone else in the audience that wanted to speak? Not. Oh, come on up. We'll give you the final word.
I'd just like to point out real quickly in rebuttal, the study that she quoted that states that it was IVIG was no more effective than placebo was since debunked, because it was given to children with psychiatric conditions, not children that were diagnosed with PANDAS. So that's off the board. The JCAP provides the standard of care, what needs to be done for these kids. There's no question about it. There's nothing experimental there at all. And in my estimation, as the other representative pointed out, the cost advantages are in favor of treatment, not in favor of ignoring the kids.
Thank you, Mr. Barnes. Mr. Barnes?
I just want to thank you all for just being here and for listening to our testimony and listening to our concerns about treating these children. As you mentioned, that 1,000 kids, that was based on 70,000 children being born a year. So just think about how many millions of children are in the state of Minnesota and are impacted by this disease process, and that we can actually make a difference. All of you came into your positions wanting to actually serve your communities and your public servants for your constituents and for all of those kids that are drowning in areas. And honestly, I will tell you, a week stay for my son was traumatic. It was the wrong place for him. He came home with just almost PTSD from staying in a mental institution when he didn't belong there. He needed medical care. So when they say antipsychotics are covered, honestly, our psychiatrist said he doesn't need antipsychotics. He needs medical care. When they say the antibiotics are covered, yeah, if you want 10 days worth, not if you want
a year.
Up until you're 21. You fight every single day. I will tell you, I spend 8 to 12 hours a day now trying to get care for my son still to this day. And I'm just one person. And I'm not here to represent just our son and our family. I'm here representing thousands of children being abandoned by the medical system, and you have the opportunity to help them and get the appropriate care. I'm here representing all these parents and all these children because it's important. And the interesting thing is, yes, we have coverage because we went to our self-funded. But you know why we got that? Is because they mandated coverage in Illinois. There was a law passed in Illinois, and they had to change their actual health care coverage through Blue Cross Blue Shield because of that mandate and that law. And that is the only way that I actually got coverage from my self-insured employer. So, yes, it's great. But I am here because now, guess what? My son, because he got so severe, is on MA. So if Blue Cross Blue Shield denies us, we're banking on you to help us out. And this kid is worth it. This kid is just one, and he's worth it. And I'm telling you, I appreciate you all listening to us. But this is a little bit of the emotion speaking in here, but this is where, you know what, you can stand up and stand tall, and you can help thousands of children in your own state and be a beacon of light for the nation. Because Illinois did it for us, and we're going to do it for the rest of the states. Whatever we can do, we're here for you, and we thank you so much for listening to our testimony.
Thank you both for your testimony. Members, I think it was a good hearing on both of the issues. Thank you to both the authors and everybody that spoke. We appreciate it. And with that, we are adjourned.